Chapter 11. The Christmas Holidays. The holidays were approaching. On the eve of the great day, only a few convicts went to work. Those who had been assigned to the tailor's shop and a few others did so as usual, but they returned almost immediately, separately or in groups. There was no work at all after dinner. From early morning, the majority were occupied with their own affairs, not with those of the administration. Some were arranging to bring in spirits, while others sought permission to visit their friends or to collect small accounts due to them for services rendered. Baklouchin and others, who were to take part in the theatrical performance, were trying to persuade some of their acquaintance, mostly officers' servants, to procure for them the necessary costumes. Some bustled about with a business-like air, simply because others were genuinely occupied. They had no money to collect, and yet seemed to expect payment. Everyone, in short, seemed to be looking for some kind of change. Towards evening, the guards who executed the convicts' commissions brought them all kinds of victuals, meat, sucking pigs, and geese. Many of the simplest and least extravagant fellows who had saved their kopecks for a whole year decided to spend something on that day, and to celebrate Christmas Eve in a worthy manner. Christmas Day itself was an even greater festival, their right to celebrate which was recognized by the regulations. Prisoners could not be sent to work on that day, and there were not three occasions like it in all the year. What memories, too, must have troubled the souls of those reprobates at the approach of so solemn a festival. The common people always retain their childhood memories of Christmas, and these men must have recalled with anguish the days when work was laid aside and they rested in the bosom of their family. There was something impressive about the convicts' respect for Christmas. There were few cases of drunkenness. Nearly everyone was serious and even preoccupied, though there was little enough to do. Even those who did themselves really well were quieter than usual. Laughter seemed out of place. A sort of intolerant susceptibility reigned throughout the prison, and if anyone interfered, even accidentally, with the general repose, he was quickly reminded of the fact with shouts of abuse. He was condemned as though he lacked respect to the festival itself. This attitude was as touching as it was remarkable. Apart from the innate veneration they have for the feast, they feel that by observing it, they enter into communion with the rest of mankind, that they are not altogether reprobates, lost and cast off by society. The rejoicings that took place in prison were the same as those outside. That was the general feeling. I saw it and experienced it myself. Akim Akimich had made great preparations for the festival. He had no memories of family life, being an orphan, born in a strange house, and sent into the army at the age of 15. He could never have experienced any profound joy, having always and everywhere lived in the dread of infringing regulations. Nor was he very religious, for his acquired formality had stifled in him all human feeling, all passion and prejudice, good or evil. He therefore prepared to spend Christmas without undue excitement. He was saddened by no painful and fruitless recollection. He did everything with the punctuality required in the execution of his duty in order to get through the ceremony as quickly as was compatible with decorum. Moreover, he did not trouble to reflect upon the significance of the day. He had never given it a thought, even punctiliously while he fulfilled his religious duties. Had he been ordered next day to do the opposite of what he had done the previous evening, he would have shown himself no less submissive. Once and once only in his life he had followed his own will, and had been sent to hard labour in consequence. This lesson had not been lost upon him, though fate had ordained that he should never understand his fault. He had yet learned the salutary moral principle that he must never reason about anything, because his mind was not equal to the task of forming a judgment. Blindly devoted to ceremonies, he looked with respect at the sucking pig, which he had stuffed with millet seed, and which he had roasted himself, for he had some culinary skill, just as if it had been no ordinary sucking pig, which could have been bought and roasted at any time, but a particular kind of animal, born specially for Christmas Day. Perhaps he had been accustomed from earliest years to see a sucking pig served up on that day, and concluded that a sucking pig was indispensable for the proper celebration of the festival. I am certain that if, through some mischance, he had failed to eat that particular dish on that particular day, he would have been troubled all his life with remorse for having failed in his duty. Until Christmas morning, he wore his old vest and his old trousers, which had long been threadbare. I then learned that he kept carefully in his box some new clothes, which had been given to him 4 months before. He had not worn them before, as he wished to do so for the first time on Christmas Day. It was perfectly true. On the previous evening he took the new clothes out of his trunk, unfolded, examined, and cleaned them. Then he blew on them to remove the dust, and being convinced that they were in good order, probably tried them on. They suited him admirably, and all the garments matched. The coat buttoned up to the neck, the collar, straight and stiff like cardboard, kept his chin in place. There was a military cut about those clothes, and Akim Akimitch smiled with satisfaction, turning himself round and round, not without swagger, before a little mirror adorned with a gilt border. One of the buttons alone seemed out of place. Akim Akimitch noticed it, and at once made the necessary alteration. He tried on the coat once more, and found it irreproachable. Then he folded everything up as before, and, with a satisfied mind, locked them up in his box until the following day. His head was well shaved, but after careful examination, he decided that it was not good enough. His hair had grown imperceptibly. Accordingly, he hurried off to his barber. In point of fact, no one would have dreamed of looking at him on Christmas morning, but he was acting conscientiously so as to do his duty. This care lest the smallest button, the least thread of an epaulet, the slightest string of a tassel should be out of place was engraved upon his mind as an imperious obligation. He looked upon it as the reflection of perfect order. As one of the old hands, he made himself responsible for seeing that hay was brought and strewed on our barrack floor, as was done in the other buildings. I do not know why, but hay was always strewed on the ground at Christmas time. As soon as Akim Akimitch had finished his work, he said his prayers, lay down on his bed, and went to sleep. He slept like a child, determined to wake up as early as possible next day. The other convicts did the same. In fact, they retired much earlier than usual. No one plied his customary evening task, and as for playing cards, no one would have dared even to mention such a thing. All looked forward anxiously to the morning. At last that morning arrived. At an early hour, even before it was light, the drum beat, and the under-officer whose duty it was to count the prisoners wished them a happy Christmas. They returned his greeting in a cheerful and friendly manner. Akim Akimitch and many others who had their geese and sucking pigs went to the kitchen, after saying their prayers in a hurried manner, to see where their victuals were and how they were being cooked. Through the little windows of our barrack room, obscured by snow and ice, we could see flaring the bright light from the two kitchens where 6 stoves had been lighted. Across the courtyard, which was still plunged in darkness, convicts, with a half-pelisse round his shoulders, or perhaps fully dressed, hurried towards the kitchens. A very few had already visited the drink-sellers. They were the impatient ones, but they were quite well-behaved, better, perhaps, than on ordinary days. There was no quarrelling or abuse. All realised that this was a great festival. Some even went to visit other barracks in order to wish the inmates a happy Christmas, for a sort of friendship seemed to exist between them all. I should mention in passing that anything like close friendship is almost unknown in convict establishments. It was very rare to see a man on confidential terms with another, as in the world outside. We were generally harsh and abrupt towards one another. With some rare exceptions, that was the general tone, purposely adopted and rigidly maintained. I went outside with the others. Day was breaking. The stars were paling. A light, cold mist was rising from the earth, and spirals of smoke were ascending from the chimneys. Several convicts whom I met smiled and wished me a happy Christmas. I thanked them and returned their wishes. Some of them had never spoken to me before. On my way to the kitchen, a prisoner from the military barracks with his sheepskin on his shoulder recognized me and called out from the middle of the courtyard, "Alexander Petrovich!" He ran towards me, and I waited for him. He was a young fellow, with a round face and soft eyes, and not at all communicative as a rule. He had not spoken to me since my arrival, and appeared never even to have noticed me. As for me, I did not know so much as his name. He came up and stood before me, smiling with a vacuous but nonetheless a happy expression. "What do you want?" I asked, not without surprise. He remained standing there, still smiling and staring, but without replying to my question. "Why, it's Christmas Day," he muttered. He discovered that he had nothing more to say, and hurried away to the kitchen. Incidentally, we scarcely ever met again, and he never afterwards spoke another word to me. Around the flaming kitchen stoves, the convicts pushed and jostled. Everyone was watching his own property. The cooks were preparing dinner, which was to be served a little earlier than usual. No one began eating before the appointed time, though a good many would have liked to do so, but one had to behave properly in company. We were waiting for the priest, and the fast preceding Christmas would not be over until he arrived. It was not quite light when the corporal, standing just inside the main gate, shouted, "Kitchens!" The call was repeated at intervals for about 2 hours. The cooks were wanted in order to receive gifts brought from all parts of the town in enormous numbers, loaves of white bread, scones, rusks, pancakes, and pastry of various kinds. I do not think there was a shopkeeper in the whole town who did not send something to the unfortunates. Some of these gifts were magnificent, and included a good many cakes of the finest flour. Others were very humble, such as rolls worth 2 kopecks apiece, and a couple of brown loaves covered lightly with sour cream. These were offerings from the poor to the poor, who had, in many cases, spent their last kopeck to procure them. All these gifts were accepted with equal gratitude, without reference to the value or to the giver. When a convict received anything, he took off his cap and thanked the donor with a low bow, wishing him a happy Christmas, and then carried his present to the kitchen. As soon as a number of loaves and cakes had been collected, the senior men of each barrack assembled and distributed the heap in equal portions among all the various sections. The distribution excited neither envy nor protest. It was made honestly and equitably. Akim Akimich, with the help of another prisoner, distributed the share allotted to our barrack and gave to each his due. All were satisfied. No objection was made by anyone. There was not the smallest sign of envy, and no one dreamed of deceiving his neighbour. When Akim Akimich had finished in the kitchen, he proceeded with the solemn rite of dressing. He fastened his coat punctiliously, button by button, and thus arrayed he began his prayers, which lasted for a considerable time. The numerous convicts who fulfilled their religious duties were for the most part old men. The younger men scarcely ever prayed. At best, they made the sign of the cross on rising from table, and then only on festival days. When he had finished praying, Akim Akimich came and offered me the usual good wishes. I invited him to take tea, and he returned the compliment by offering me some of his sucking pig. Later, Petrov came and wished me a happy Christmas. I think he had been drinking, for although he seemed to have much to say, he scarcely uttered a word. He stood there for some moments, and then went back to the kitchen. The priest was now expected in the military section. Their barrack was arranged differently from the rest. Bedsteads stood against the walls, and not in the middle of the room. The idea was probably to facilitate the parading of convicts in an emergency. A small table had been prepared in the middle of the room. On it stood an icon, before which burned a little lamp. At last, the priest arrived with the cross and holy water. He prayed and chanted before the icon, and then turned towards the convicts, who came and kissed the crucifix one after another. The priest then walked through each barrack, sprinkling it with holy water. When he entered the kitchen, he remarked on the excellence of prison bread, which had indeed quite a reputation in town. The convicts at once volunteered to send him a couple of fresh loaves straight from the oven, and a soldier was detailed to take them to his house forthwith. The convicts escorted the cross on its return journey with the same respect as that with which they had received it. Very soon afterwards, the governor and deputy governor arrived. The deputy was liked and even respected. He accompanied his chief on a tour of inspection, wished the convicts a happy Christmas, and then went into the kitchen, where he tasted the cabbage soup. It was excellent that day. Each convict was entitled to nearly a pound of meat, in addition to which there was millet seed, and the butter had certainly not been spared. The governor saw his deputy to the door, and then ordered the convicts to start dinner. Each man tried to avoid his notice. They hated his spiteful, inquisitorial look from behind his spectacles, as he strode up and down, apparently looking for some disorder to repress, some crime to punish. We dined. Akim Akimich's sucking pig was admirably roasted. I could never understand how it was that within 5 minutes of the governor's departure, the room was full of drunken men, all of whom had appeared stone-cold sober as long as he remained. Ruddy, radiant faces were now everywhere, and balalaiki, Russian banjos, were soon produced. Next came the little Polish fiddler, whom some convivial fellow had engaged for the day to play lively dance tunes. The conversation became more animated and more noisy, but dinner ended without serious trouble. Everyone had had enough, and some of the older, more serious-minded convicts went straight to bed. So did Akim Akimich, who probably thought it was his duty to sleep after dinner on festival days. The old believer from Starodoub took 40 winks and then climbed onto the stove, where he opened his book and continued to pray until late in the evening. He declared himself shocked at the sight of so shameless an orgy. All the Circassians left the table. They looked with curiosity, but with a touch of disgust at this drunken crowd. I met Nora. "Aman, aman," he said, with a burst of honest indignation and shaking his head. "What an offence to Allah!" Isaiah Fomich, with an arrogant and obstinate air, lit a candle in his favourite corner, and set to work in order to show that in his eyes this was no holiday. Here and there card parties were arranged. The players were not worried about the soldiers, but men were placed on the lookout in case the officer of the guard came along. He, however, was careful to turn a blind eye to what was going on. He made altogether 3 rounds. The prisoners, if they were drunk, promptly hid themselves, and the cards disappeared in the twinkling of an eye. I believe he had resolved to overlook minor breaches of the regulations, for drunkenness was not treated as an offence that day. Little by little, everyone became more or less gay. There were occasional quarrels, but the majority of prisoners remained calm, amusing themselves with the spectacle of their drunken companions, some of whom had put away enormous quantities of liquor. Gazin was triumphant. He strutted about with a self-satisfied air by the side of his bed, underneath which he had hidden a store of vodka. Until Christmas Day, He had kept it concealed in the snow behind our barrack room. He smiled knowingly when he saw customers arrive in crowds. He was perfectly sober. Indeed, he had drunk nothing at all, for he intended to regale himself on the last day of the holidays after he had emptied everyone else's pocket. The prison was becoming an inferno of drunkenness. Singing was heard, and songs gradually gave way to tears. Some of the prisoners walked about in bands, sheepskins on shoulders, proudly plucking the strings of their balalaiki. A chorus of from 8 to 10 men had been formed in the special section. The singing here was excellent, with its accompaniment of balalaiki and guitars. Songs of a truly popular kind were rare. I remember one which was admirably sung. Yesterday I, a young girl, went to the feast. A variation hitherto unknown to me was introduced, and at the end of the song the following lines were added. At my house, the house of a young girl, everything is in order. I have washed the spoons, I have turned out the cabbage soup, I have wiped down the panels of the door, I have cooked the patties. But for the most part they sang prison songs, one of them called As It Happened, which was most amusing. It told how a man amused himself and lived like a prince until he was sent to prison, where he fared very differently. Another very popular number explained how the hero had once owned capital, but now possessed nothing but captivity. Here is a true convict song. The day breaks in the heavens. We are waked up by the drum. The old man opens his door. The warder comes and calls us. No one sees us behind the prison walls, nor how we live in this place. But God, the heavenly Creator, is with us. He will not let us perish. Another, still more melancholy, but set to glorious music, was spoiled by its tame and inaccurate wording. I can remember a few of the verses. My eyes no more will see the land where I was born. To suffer torments undeserved will be my punishment. The owl will shriek upon the roof and raise the echoes of the forest. My heart is broken down with grief. No, never more shall I return. This is a favourite solo piece, and is seldom sung in chorus. When the day's work is done, a prisoner will go outside, squat on the doorstep, and meditate with his chin in his hand. Presently, he begins to drawl a song in high falsetto. We listen, and the effect is heart-rending. Some of the men had beautiful voices. Dusk was closing in. Wearisomeness and general depression were making themselves felt after drunkenness and debauchery. One fellow, who an hour beforehand was holding his sides with laughter, now sat in a corner, maudlin drunk. Others fought or tottered about the barracks, pale, very pale, and looking for someone with whom to quarrel. The poor creatures had meant to spend a merry Christmas, but for most of them it had proved an unhappy day. They had looked vaguely for a joy that was beyond their reach. For instance, on the two occasions that I ran across Petrov, he was sober enough, having drunk next to nothing. Yet right up to the last, he was expecting something extraordinary to happen. He did not say so, but you could read it in his eyes. He ran tirelessly from one barrack to another, but found nothing but general intoxication, the meaningless abuse of drunken men, and the giddiness of overheated brains. Sirotkin, too, wandered about the barracks, dressed in a brand-new red shirt, and good-looking as ever. He, too, was on the watch for something to happen. The spectacle was most unpleasant. Indeed, it became quite nauseating. There were some amusing incidents, but I was too sad to be entertained. I felt a deep pity for all these men, whose company seemed to strangle, stifle me. Here are two convicts disputing as to which of them should treat the other. The argument lasts long. They have almost come to blows. One of them has, for long, borne a grudge against the other. Stammering with indignation, he tries to prove his companion acted dishonestly a year before by selling a police for him and keeping back the money. Nor is this the end of it. The complainant is a tall, well-developed young fellow, quiet, by no means stupid, but who, when drunk, wishes to make friends with everyone and to pour out his grief. He insults his adversary for the sake of the reconciliation that he hopes will follow. The other man, a big, massive person with a round face and as cunning as a fox, has perhaps drunk more than his companion, but he appears only slightly intoxicated. He is supposed to be rich, and may therefore be presumed to have no ulterior motive in irritating his companion, whom he accordingly leads to one of the drink sellers. The other fellow declares that his companion owes him money in any case, and is therefore bound to stand him a drink, if he has any pretensions to be considered an honest man. The drink seller, not without respect for the customer and a touch of contempt for his argumentative friend who was going to drink at someone else's expense, took a glass and filled it with vodka. "Now, Stepka, you'll have to pay. After all, you owe me money." "I won't tire my tongue talking to you any longer," replied Stepka. "Now, Stepka, you lie," continued his friend, seizing the glass offered by the drink seller. "You owe me money. You can't have any conscience. You haven't a thing on you that's not borrowed. I don't believe your very eyes are your own, in fact, Stepka. You're a blackguard. What are you whining about? Look, you're spilling your vodka. Since you're being treated, why don't you drink up?" cries the drink seller to the argumentative friend. "I can't wait here all night." "I'll drink up, don't you fear. What are you worrying about?" "My best wishes for the day." "My best wishes for the day, Stepka Dorovitch." And he bows, glass in hand, towards Stepka, whom a moment ago he called a blackguard. "Good health to you, and may you live another 100 years. He drinks, gives a grunt of satisfaction, and wipes his mouth. "What a lot of brandy I've drunk," he says, gravely speaking to everyone, but without addressing anyone in particular. "But I've finished now. Say thank you, Stepka Dorovitch." "There is nothing to thank you for." "Ah, then you won't thank me. Then I'll tell everyone what you did to me, and that you're a scoundrel." "Then I shall have something to tell you, you drunkard," interrupts Stepka, who at last loses patience. "Listen to me now. Let us divide the world in two. You shall take one half, I the other. Then I shall have peace." "Then you'll not give me back my money?" "What money, you drunken sot?" "My money, that I earned with the sweat of my brow and the labour of my hands." "You'll be sorry for it in the next world. You'll be roasted for those 5 kopecks. Go to the devil. What are you driving me for? Am I a horse? Be off, be off. Blackguard, convict." And the insults exchanged were worse than they had been before the visit to the drink seller. Another couple of friends are seated, each on his own bed. One is tall, vigorous, fleshy, with a red face, a regular butcher. He is on the verge of weeping, for he has been deeply moved. The other is tall, thin, conceited, with an immense nose which always seems to have a cold, and little blue eyes fixed upon the ground. He is a clever, well-bred man, and was formerly a secretary. He treats his friend with a trace of contempt which the latter cannot endure. They have been drinking together all day. "You have taken a liberty with me," cried the stout one, shaking his companion's head with his left hand. To take a liberty means, in prison slang, to strike. This convict, formerly a non-commissioned officer, secretly envies his neighbour's elegance, and endeavours to make up for his material grossness by refined conversation. "I tell you, you are wrong," says the secretary in a dogmatic tone, with his eyes obstinately fixed on the ground and without looking at his companion. "You struck me, do you hear?" continued the other, still shaking his dear friend.
You're the only man in the world I care for, but you shan't take a liberty with me.
Confess, my dear fellow, replies the secretary, that all this is the result of too much drink. The corpulent friend staggers backward, peers drunkenly at the secretary, whom he suddenly hits with all his strength right between the eyes. Thus terminates the day's friendship. The victim disappears unconscious beneath the bedstead. An acquaintance of mine now entered the room. He belonged to the special section, and was a very good-natured, gay fellow, far from stupid, and jocular without malice. He was the man who, on my arrival at the prison, was looking out for a rich peasant, the man who spoke so much of his self-respect, and ended by drinking my tea. He was 40 years old, had enormous lips, and a fat, fleshy red nose. He held a balalaika, and idly plucked its strings. He was followed by a little convict with a large head, whom I knew very little, and to whom no one paid any attention. Now that he was drunk, he had attached himself to Vermalov, and followed him about like his shadow, at the same time gesticulating and striking the wall and bedsteads. He was almost in tears. Vermalov took as much notice of him as if he had not existed. The most curious fact was that these two men had absolutely nothing in common. They were utterly different in outlook and occupation. They belonged to different sections, and lived in separate barracks. The little fellow's name was Bulkin. Vermalov smiled when he saw me seated at the stove. He stopped at some distance from me, reflected for a moment, tottered, and then came towards me with an affected swagger. Then he swept the strings of his instrument, and sang, or rather recited, beating time with the toe of his boot. "My darling, with her full fair face, sings like a nightingale, in her satin dress, with its brilliant trimming. She is very fair." This song roused Bulkin to an extraordinary pitch of excitement. He waved his arms and shouted for the benefit of all and sundry. "He lies, my friends. He lies like a quack doctor. There is not a shadow of truth in what he sings." "My respects to the venerable Alexander Petrovich," said Vermalov, looking at me with a knowing smile. I fancied he was even going to embrace me. He was drunk. That expression, "my respects to the venerable so-and-so," is used by the common people throughout Siberia, and may refer even to a young man of 20. To call a man old is a sign of respect, and may amount even to flattery. "Well, Vermalov, how are you?" I replied. "So-so, nothing to boast of. Those who really enjoy the holiday have been drinking since early morning." The rest of the sentence was inaudible. "He lies! He lies again!" said Bulkin, striking the beds as if in despair. Still Vermalov ignored him, so deliberately that he might have sworn an oath to do so. That was really the most comic thing about it, for Bulkin had not quitted his side the whole day, finding fault with every word he spoke, wringing his hands and striking his fists against the wall and the beds till he made them bleed. He suffered visibly from his conviction that Vermalov lied like a quack doctor. If Bulkin had had any hair on his head, he would certainly have torn it out in a fury of disappointment. One might have thought he had assumed responsibility for Vermalov's behaviour, and that all Vermalov's faults troubled his conscience. The amusing part of it was that Vermalov continued as before. "He lies! He lies! He lies!" cried Bulkin. "What can it matter to you?" replied the convicts with a laugh. "I must tell you, Alexander Petrovich, that I was very good-looking when I was a young man, and the young girls were very fond of me," said Vermalov suddenly. "He lies! He lies!" interrupted Bulkin with a groan. The convicts burst out laughing. "And I dressed to kill, too. Red shirt and broad trousers of cotton velvet. I was happy in those days. I got up when I liked and did whatever I pleased.
In fact, he lies, declared Bulkin. I inherited from my father a house built of stone and two stories high. Within 2 years I had spent both stories. Nothing remained to me but the street door. But what of it? Money comes and goes like a bird. He lies, declared Bulkin, more resolutely than before. When I had spent all my money and wrote and asked my relations for more, they considered that I had defied them and been disrespectful. It is now 7 years since I posted that letter. Any answer? I asked with a smile. No, he replied, also laughing and thrusting his face close to mine. He then informed me that he had a sweetheart. You, a sweetheart? Honorfrield told me the other day, my girl's marked with smallpox, ugly as hell, but she has plenty of dresses. Yours may be pretty, but she's a beggar. Is that so? Certainly she is a beggar, he answered. He roared with laughter, and everyone joined in, for they all knew he had a liaison with a beggar woman, to whom he gave 10 kopecks every 6 months. Well, what do you want with me? I asked, wishing now to get rid of him. He remained silent, and then, looking at me in a most insinuating manner, said, "Couldn't you let me have enough to buy half a pint? I've drunk nothing but tea the whole day," he added, taking the money I offered him. "And tea doesn't agree with me. I'm afraid of becoming asthmatic. Besides, it gives me the wind." When Bulkin saw him accept the money, his indignation knew no bounds. He gesticulated like a man possessed. "Good people all!" he cried. "The man lies. Everything he says, it's all a lie." "What's that to do with you?" the convicts shouted, astonished at his behaviour. "You're possessed!" "I will not allow him to be," continued Bulkin, rolling his eyes and striking his fist with energy on the bedboards. "He shall not lie." There was more laughter. Fermalov had obtained what he wanted. He bowed and ran off, grimacing, to the drink-seller. Then only did he notice Bulkin. "Come," he said, as if Bulkin were indispensable for the execution of some design. "Idiot," he added contemptuously, as his companion passed before him. Enough of this tumultuous scene, which was soon over. The convicts turned in and slept heavily, talking and raving in their sleep, more than on other nights. A few continued playing cards. The festival, looked forward to with such impatience, was now over, and tomorrow, the daily round, the hard labour, would begin again.